from TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer's writers to take a break from writing and reporting to say things to you on the radio instead. I have with me Patrick Michaels.
Hi.
How's it going?
Great. How are you?
Good. And joining us from New York is freelance writer Christopher Hooks, who's been having a very interesting time covering stories for the Observer in Tarrant County and San Antonio as well. How are you doing, Chris?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Good. So, Chris, let's start with the story out of Tarrant County. I believe that there was something that Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst said, some sort of important statement.
Sure. Well, it was a kind of a weekly event put on by the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party. I had originally wanted to go up because Kathy Adams, the Texas lieutenant of Phyllis Schlafly's American Eagle Forum, had been slated to deliver a lecture about the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood into Texas politics.
I've been saving that Khan Academy lesson to watch later on tonight as well about the Muslim Brotherhood's infiltration.
Oh, yeah. you'll learn quite a bit.
The more you know.
Enlightening. And before the kind of festivities began, four of the Texas lieutenant governor candidates had been slated to do kind of a brief meet and greet, along with Ken Paxton, the attorney general candidate, and Deborah Medina, who's the kind of Tea Party darling who's running for comptroller. And on the way up there, I have to say I didn't really expect much to come from the candidate forum. I hoped to be able to ask them a little bit about Kathy Adams' presentation. But as soon as I got there, as soon as the candidate forum began, when the four lieutenant governor candidates got up to the front of this packed Lutheran church to give their pitch to the meeting, David Dewhurst launched kind of right into a pitch that I hadn't heard him make before. Right after his opening joke, he told the crowd that he thought Barack Obama should be impeached. And it was the first time I'd heard him say that, and the first time I'd heard any of the candidates say that.
And his phrasing was one of my favorite things about it, because as you quote him in there, he says, I don't know about you, but Barack Obama ought to be impeached. I think that's right.
Yeah, that's what I've got here.
Which kind of makes me think that, you know, he's been kind of eyeing everyone around in the room and thinking, well, maybe they ought to go too.
This is the time.
Yeah. The jury's out, I guess, but he could come back with a different opinion on that. But
it's kind of like Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll stop.
And then he launched into his kind of a general campaign pitch, and the other lieutenant governor candidates stood up to speak, and not much was surprising about that. Senator Dan Patrick hit David Dewhurst pretty squarely for some of what he's been doing during the legislative session, and I thought his body language was very interesting, kind of. Once he was done, left the line of the other candidates and stood in the corner of the room apart from them. Jerry Patterson got up to talk about guns a little bit, and Todd Staples, the kind of same person I'd seen at every campaign event. And my question was whether or not this was a line that David Dewhurst had tested with his people and planned to introduce, or something that he came up with because he knew he was facing a crowd that would demand quite a bit of red meat. And the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party has had a history of this kind of thing. U.S. Congressman Michael Burgess flirted with the idea of impeaching the president way back in 2011, really just to tie the president's hands legislatively and not for any substantive reason. So I went up to David Dewhurst afterward to talk to him about it, and he did seem a little surprised to see me, but he launched into some reasons for impeaching the president, which it seemed like he had thought about.
And they're all really good reasons, right? That are rooted in strict fact and were well researched.
Absolutely. he convinced me. And the reasons seem to be the president's executive decisions concerning the implementation of Obamacare, Eric Holder's drug law reform pushes in the last couple of months, and Benghazi. And he repeated this idea that's gained quite a bit of currency in some right-wing circles, that the president and his team were watching the attacks that go down in Benghazi and refused to send help, either out of malice or cowardice. It's never really made clear. And that's something that has been repeatedly debunked over the course of about a year. And,
right. You dismiss this rather quickly in your piece.
It's something that has been talked quite a bit about, and it's not very difficult once you read about the issue to kind of discover there's not a lot to those claims. So it was interesting to me if this was something that Dewhurst had planned to say, and that this was the kind of argument he trotted out. Didn't seem like, but I still wonder if this was something that if this was a line that he had tested, if this was a decision that he had made or something that kind of let slip.
Well, let's go from there and talk about another event where Jerry Patterson was present.
So we'll follow the Jerry Patterson thread here.
Yeah.
The narrative.
We'll see how deep the rabbit hole goes. We have to stop saying that. We say it like every episode. Anyway, tell us about what happened at the Alamo.
Sure.
If you remember from history class.
So this is, for gun rights activists in the state, there's been a great deal of consternation over the last couple months about some instances where individuals with sporting rifles or assault weapons were present in different cities around Texas and were either cited or kind of harassed by the cops, is their view. And there's one case in Belton where there was a trial regarding this, a man was walking with an assault rifle in the city and was arrested by the cops. At the Alamo on Saturday, a great number of these people who were kind of incensed by the recent actions of Texas police departments gathered in the Alamo Plaza in front of the memorial with their assault weapons and sporting rifles. To listen to a number of speakers and to galvanize each other to fight what they see are these unjust laws that are penalizing their rights to carry weapons in Texas cities.
Right, and there were a few speakers, and you point out that the two perhaps most notable ones were Jerry Patterson and
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones,
the other one.
Yeah.
Sure. So Jerry Patterson, in his run for lieutenant governor, has almost exclusively focused on Second Amendment issues. When he was in the Texas legislature, he wrote the state's concealed carry law. And when he appeared in front of the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party at this previous event, he talked almost exclusively about his history with guns. He's an ex-Marine, and his attitude towards expanding gun rights in the state. That's his core issue. So in a sense, it was an obvious thing to do for him to appear before this crowd. There were a lot of people who were very excited to see him there. He spoke very favorably about his decision to appear. But in the course of appearing at this event, he also shared stage with another passionate supporter of expanding gun rights in Texas, Alex Jones, the kind of conspiracy peddler and talk radio host who, among other things, believes that the Bush administration concocted and executed 9/11 for what are kind of unclear reasons, and that the Obama administration is attempting to herd Americans into concentration camps through FEMA.
Right.
So it was another case of the kind of what you would see is the more establishment wing of the Republican Party in the state sharing a stage or kind of entertaining the beliefs of some people that they probably don't have a lot of in common with and who operate on the kind of bedrock of fear and paranoia.
So you have this quote in here that I read, and I think it sort of exemplifies this duality here. The quote is from Alex Jones, and he's talking about Jerry Patterson, and he says, "I've known him forever. He's a really great guy, and he gave a really great measured speech." And then you write, later he added, "A disarmed people are slaves," which was sort of non sequitur. And I mean, was that sort of how he was during that event?
Yeah, he's if you've ever heard him speak, he kind of keeps the same meter, whether he's talking to one person or a thousand. He's an amazing guy in person. He's a force of nature. Wherever he went at that event, he was followed around by two or three cameras from his organization. He's really quite amazing guy. But his speech was entirely about the kind of globalist agenda. What he sees as a push from the elite and the powerful to take away Americans' guns. And when I talked to Jerry Patterson afterwards about whether or not his presence there kind of legitimated some of these views or legitimated Alex Jones, Jerry Patterson kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, I don't agree with everything he says, and I don't approve of some of these views, but what am I going to do, push him off the stage? It's true that he can't push someone like Alex Jones off the stage at this event, or presumably he doesn't have the influence with this event. It is true that his kind of presence there lends people like Alex Jones and some other people that were in the crowd that day kind of a greater legitimacy to some of their claims.
Do you think there's any damage to someone like Patterson for doing that, for, you know, sharing a stage with Alex Jones during his campaign now? I mean, with Dewhurst kind of, you know, going so far out of the way to kind of try and outflank everyone on the right talking about impeachment. Is there any risk politically to these guys for doing things like this?
Well, the kind of peculiar thing about the event was the roster of speakers and some of the extreme rhetoric that was coming from both the speakers and the crowd is that it allowed Jerry Patterson to play a moderate. Uh-huh. He got up and told the crowd not, you know, to be polite to the San Antonio Police Department and to respect the site. And he came off in a way as kind of the most reasonable sounding or sane speaker at the event. It was quite the opposite of what I had expected when I showed up that day.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, earlier this week, Apple announced a new wave of computers and tablets, and topical as always, Patrick Michaels is working on an Apple-related story now.
That was pure coincidence.
I'm sure it was. This story is focused on iPads mm-hmm. in schools, which is something that Patrick and I are both very interested in. So, Patrick, what's going on?
Okay, well, the story that I'm working on, and it'll be up soon if it's not already while you're listening to this, it's about Fort Bend ISD, which is one of the very biggest school districts in the state. It's Sugar Land, Southwest Houston. And they had a great big iPad initiative called iAchieve with a lowercase I, so you know it's cool.
Fits in the with the brand.
Kids are gonna love it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was launched in 2012, kind of early 2012, and it was supposed to be about a year long to get this thing going. It was a science program. They were going to give iPads to every kid in the schools. They piloted it in three grades. That was how they were going to start it. And it was just a colossal disaster. It was about $16 million for the program. And they spent most of that, I think, if they haven't spent all of it. And they just pulled the plug on the program earlier this month. So it seemed like a good time, I thought, to sort of look around the state and take stock of where these iPad and other tablet programs are. In the last 2 years, especially when Apple announced its textbook, that it was getting into the textbook market, they were going to revolutionize education. You saw those stories all over the place.
Right.
Kind of here and there, districts started coming up with their own programs, just sort of a piecemeal thing. So now, I went around and counted the best. I can tell there are a little over 20 school districts that have iPad or similar tablet distribution programs, and Fort Bend's was the most disastrous and also probably the most ambitious one. But there are a lot of other ones that sort of, you know, take different approaches to the deal.
So what didn't work in Fort Bend?
So a number of things, and it, you know, we're helped along in understanding it by this audit that the school board commissioned. But the biggest thing was that they tried to do too much too fast. They wanted to buy these iPads, outfit all the schools for wireless, create new lessons and new interactive, like, simulations. So you can dissect a frog on your iPad instead right. of on a frog.
Instead of the good old-fashioned way.
Right. There's actually, like, a remarkable number of frog dissection simulators online, if you look it up.
That seems like what you would design to, like, demonstrate, like, this is how it could be used.
That's where you
for
start,
education.
Right? Yeah. No, you don't get your hands messy because you're, you know, touching
it's
an
virtual
iPad.
Blood.
Frogguts.com is probably the most easily memorable one if you're by a computer. So they commissioned a company out there to like basically take their science teacher's expertise. They'd come up with a list of things to put in a simulation, and they had a separate company they hired to build the platform and a number of simulations. So they did all that. The company said, no problem, we're going to do this all really quick. It's going to be great. And then as the months went on, they tried things out in classrooms, and it was just not working out. Kind of at every step of the way, they kept coming back and saying, well, this isn't working. Let's try this a little bit differently. And then they started saying, well, maybe it shouldn't just be science. Maybe we'll try it for everything.
Right.
From the early on, there were parents who were wondering why they're spending all this money on iPads in the first place, why the district seems so like hell-bent on pushing this thing through. And my favorite thing about this report was looking at who they hired to build this platform. It was a $1 million contract. And the company was formed the day that it put in its bid to do the job. And it actually scored the highest of all the companies bidding on it in the category of like expertise and track record, even though the company didn't even exist before it submitted its bid.
Yeah, that seems like a disconnect.
But the woman who ran the company, and nominally still does, I guess, was known to the district because she also sold the district its character development handouts so that students would learn about respect and being nice to one another.
Right.
And it was like a set of handouts that the district did very well with. But she decided to get into the iPad platform business, and this is kind of what you got.
And there are also some things I've been hearing about like iPad or iOS 7 was released, and now kids can access all these things that they couldn't access before.
This is a big thing in Los Angeles, which sort of is the best known school iPad disaster around the country. And basically the problem was that kids are kids and they know how to use these things.
Right.
And we'll figure figure out how to get around whatever you try and put in their way. So they were, got right around the school security stuff and were checking out the Facebooks and the
right.
Twitters and, anything else the district didn't want them doing.
Right.
Louisville, north of Dallas, same thing happened. They updated to OS 7 and all of a sudden all the security stuff was wiped off. And, it was a field day for, whatever these little hellions wanted to get into.
You mean like use the internet?
Yeah.
Like pretty much.
The internet, basically.
Right.
Or on Wikipedia.
Right.
So anyway, so if I were, the nice thing about this Fort Bend thing is that it was so there were so many good lessons for other districts that are trying this out of what,
sure.
what not to do. And basically, first thing, make sure you get your wireless set up in all the schools. Don't rush that and don't try and put in stopgaps to make that go faster. And just kind of, the districts that I think are having the most success have kind of built slowly, and they'll start with a classroom or two and see how it goes and not try and kind of get out in front of all the other schools.
Can you name names? Which districts are doing this well?
Well, Eanes ISD was one of the first ones. They're around Austin. And they're also one of the wealthier districts here. They had bond money that they used to get iPads for everybody. So it's a big program now that has one of the longest track records, I think, of anyone in the state. And McAllen actually has by far the biggest one. They have about 20,000 to 25,000 iPads they've bought. For comparison, Fort Bend is the next highest, and they had like 6,000 that they'd gotten.
Right.
So it's a whole lot of these things, but by all accounts, they're doing pretty well with it. And so they actually are known as kind of one of the most ambitious ones out there. The problem with it, I think, is like a lot of things that are cutting edge in schools, there's a big prestige thing that comes along with having an iPad program, a signature technology initiative. You get invited to conferences, the superintendent gets their name out there as a thought leader in schools. That's sort of a dangerous temptation when you're dealing with things that, really depends on the first priority should be like, what does your school need?
Right.
Maybe it's not iPads. Maybe it's something with a keyboard. Maybe it's something that's cheaper than an iPad, but kind of does a lot of the same stuff. So the biggest lesson I think from Fort Bend is probably build your program based on kind of from the ground up, with what you need in the classrooms, not what you want to be able to tell people you're doing.
Well, awesome. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
You can read more about iPads in Patrick Michael's story, which will appear on TexasObserver.org very soon if it's not there already. Joining me now by phone is Observer film columnist Josh Rosenblatt, who recently reviewed a few independent films in anticipation of the Austin Film Festival, which started yesterday. So, Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, let's talk about these films. The first one is Little Hope Was Arson, which is a documentary about church burnings, but seemingly much, much more than that.
Absolutely, yeah. This was a documentary that came out, or is just coming out right now. It's a fascinating documentary about a series of church burnings that took place in East Texas. About 11 churches burned over the course of about a month in East Texas back in 2010. And this documentary sort of starts off as a police procedural, sort of going through the process of how they figured out who perpetrated these crimes and the why behind it, and really turns into, over the course of the film, a sort of fascinating investigation of religious faith and religious, I guess, what you could call skepticism or doubt in a community that is really not familiar with religious doubt, which is the evangelical Christian community, particularly in places like East Texas.
Cool. Patrick, you said you were interested in this film.
No, I mean, I loved your piece on it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the documentary for this point that you kind of bring up at the end, which is that it sounds like many of the church communities end up, in a way, kind of blaming themselves for what happened to their church buildings and coming to understand it, that what the arson is a failure of the community to stay together.
Well, I appreciate that. It's actually really, really fascinating in that what I talk about in the review and what struck me about the movie is, over the course of the film, what you realize is that when you have a religious community like that, like, for example, evangelical Christianity, where people really believe that they have a personalized relationship with God, not sort of in an abstract way, but actually in, you know, your day-to-day life. You communicate with him, he changes things, he affects things, he has a role in your life. When you believe that, in that sort of personal relationship, when things go wrong, it can become what would maybe to someone who was not a believer be sort of a necessary or fundamental part of existence, can sort of become something of a calamity and a catastrophe. And you see that throughout the film, both in terms of the two young men who were found guilty of burning the churches, who were, when they were younger, both extremely religious people, and they both sort of came on hard or disappointing times. One of them had a death in the family, the other one sort of had a falling out with a girlfriend, and they both, because of this sort of notion of a personalized relationship with God that they were raised to believe in, they took that disappointment and turned it into sort of they saw it as sort of a breach of faith with God, that God had sort of turned his back on them, and they essentially say that they turned their back on God and attacked God by burning his churches down. Now, where it really gets fascinating is when you talk to the various members of the church community who are what you might call the victims of the crimes, the people that were in these churches, the pastors, the parishioners, the believers, how many of them that the filmmaker talks to who see the church burnings as a failure on their own part, again, sort of as a reflection of this personal relationship with God, that there has to be a reason for everything, that God wouldn't allow something like this to happen simply to let it happen, that there has to be a reason for things. And the sort of irony becomes that they, despite the fact that they sort of see their failure to get outside of their own church buildings, to evangelize, to be out there in the world helping these kids who had essentially gotten away from the church and lost their faith, they felt like they barricaded themselves inside the building. They saw the church as being the four walls, as the brick and mortar, rather than as I understand it, sort of a true Christian would believe, the church being the entirety of the world and all the people in it. And as a consequence, there's quite a bit of blame and quite a bit of doubt and quite a bit of self-reflection, I guess, that went on within that community, where they really felt that they, to a certain extent, that they were responsible for those church burnings, because, ironically enough, they had not left the church.
Right. Okay. Well, what about some of these other films? Can you talk to us a little bit about Dear Sidewalk?
Dear Sidewalk is a sort of a quirky, independent comedy by a director named Jake Olerman. It's shot in Austin, Texas, and has sort of a very sort of Austin, Texas kind of a feel. The sort of fascinating thing about this, it's the story of a 25-year-old or about to become a 25-year-old young man who's living in Austin who is a mailman, and he's essentially having a quarter-life crisis coming up on his 25th birthday, and he's sort of a deadpan, dispassionate young guy who's sort of detached from the world. He's got one friend and no romantic prospects, and he sort of lives for his job, and he lives for sort of the routine of his job. And this is sort of a classic story of a man who meets a woman, and she sort of pulls him out of his routine and himself, and helps him see the broader world around him. What I wrote about in the review that I sort of found very fascinating about this movie is that the way the movie is shot, the way the language that the filmmakers use is directly a reflection of the sort of mentality of this main character named Gardner, that, again, that he sees his life, and he sees life in general as sort of a series of routines and a series of ritualized behaviors, that the film is shot in a similar way. There's sort of every scene is set up in a very, very particular, almost persnickety way, and there's a lot of repeated behaviors, and it's when I was watching the film, I was thinking to myself that these guys really sort of set out to make a movie that, where the way the movie was made was really reflective of the message that was coming across in the movie, or at least the message that the protagonist sees his life as being before his redemption, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, there's a million and one examples, but, you know, this sort of, one could call them sort of easy metaphors. I think I talked about the filmmaking style being the one of sort of the cinema of direct symbology or something like that, something along those lines, where, for example, he's a mailman, and the notion that people don't communicate by mail anymore, right, was sort of like a clear indication they really wanted to get that point across, that he wasn't communicating with people, and he had a job where people couldn't communicate with people anymore. Or, for example, he owns, you know, his prized possession is a valuable stamp, and he's got it in a glass case in his home, and he refuses to use it, and it's sort of this, what this thing was built for, the stamp, was to allow for human beings to communicate with each other, but he sort of petrified it and ossified it and put it in the frame and put it in the cage, and which is sort of a metaphor for his own life. And then, of course, you know, by the end of the movie, when not to give away too much, but he uses that stamp to actually send a letter to someone who is meaningful to him, and it's sort of a nice and easy and a metaphor for this guy breaking out of his shell and actually attempting to make connections with another human being.
You know, I have to say that I've lived in Austin for a large portion of my life, and I have definitely never met anyone like this.
Waiting for life to happen? No.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, we've unfortunately...
Sending mail.
Yeah.
Never met anyone.
Right. I think
that.
I know where the post office is. No, I'm just kidding.
There's got to be a post office somewhere around.
Yeah. Josh, we really appreciate you showing up on the show via phone.
Absolutely.
And incidentally, not via letter, because nobody does that anymore.
There you go. I'm talking to you on a very fancy iPhone right now.
There's actually one other film that Josh Rosenblatt reviewed. You can find that on texasobserver.org. The film is Sombras de Azul, and you can find all of these films at the Austin Film Festival. Deer Sidewalk is playing today, Friday, and Little Hope Was Arson also is playing today. So go out and check out those movies if you can. And Josh, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time for this episode of Observer Radio, but previous episodes are available at texasobserver.org. Before we go, I would like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music. And of course, I'd like to thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time on Observer Radio.